All right, so welcome and good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241. It's February 23rd. You had your first lecture exam on Tuesday, and the exams are graded. They're in Blackboard. Everybody's grade should be in there, unless you didn't give me an ID or you put your Scantron in the wrong pile or maybe a bunch of other reasons. All right, but they're there. I'd like for everybody to come and view the test to make sure that your Scantron's graded properly. And also by reading the questions again, you see how the tests are written and you'll do better and better and better on each subsequent test, right? So that's really handy. Don't forget the exam figures. I don't know if I had another announcement. I guess not, but see me during office hours. I have a little bit of time right after lecture to show a few people their tests, so come on up to my office right after lecture. Maybe I can have you review your test at that time. I think that's it. So we're going to move on to the next chapter, which are enzymes. We're going to talk about enzymes. Probably you talked about enzymes already in lab, all right, somewhat, but we're going to just review some important concepts because we're just a baggie filled with water and a whole bunch of chemical reactions going on inside that baggie, right? So it's important to know a lot about chemical reactions and how they're controlled inside your body, and that's the job of enzymes. All right, and we haven't talked about this, but on the board I have a chemical reaction taking place. So I think I actually want to start here. All right, so we have two reactants, A and B. They combine together, they rearrange themselves, they produce products, and we're going to call those C and D. And so that's a basic understanding of what I want you to look at today. And the things that might control this particular reaction right here is an enzyme. And an enzyme is a biological catalyst, right? A biological catalyst means that it's a biological molecule, like it could be a protein, could be a lipid, could be a nucleic acid, right? Or it could be a carbohydrate, but almost 100% of the time it's going to be a protein, right? Which has amino acids as its basic building block. And the primary structure of that protein has to be correct in order for the protein to have the right shape. All right, so an enzyme has to have the right shape in order for it to produce its job. And we have to define what a catalyst is. There are two things that make a catalyst. A catalyst speeds up the rate of a chemical reaction. It makes it happen very fast. Maybe the reaction wants to take place and will eventually take place in 1 million years or 2 million years, but if there's a catalyst available, it will happen just in the blink of an eye. Okay, so that's one thing that a catalyst does, is that it speeds up the rate of a chemical reaction. A catalyst cannot make a reaction happen that won't happen by itself thermodynamically anyway, right? But it will just speed up the rate of a reaction that will take place. The other thing about a catalyst is that a catalyst is not used up during the reaction. Right, so I don't have a catalyst on this board. Sometimes we would put a catalyst over the arrow right here, and a catalyst then never becomes part of the product, never gets used up, never becomes part of the product, and it can catalyze the reaction over and over and over again. Right, so it might have a long lifespan. And a catalyst will do its job by lowering the activation energy required for a reaction to proceed. All right, so that's a really important kind of concept, and I think that's what these next slides right here show. So here we have a couple of graphs. Let's look at the axes of these graphs. So here we have an energy, right? We're going to have number of reactant molecules plotted out versus energy, right? So not every reactant that you have in a solution is at exactly the same energy level. So every A molecule that you have in a beaker doesn't contain the same energy. There's a distribution of energies, and sometimes we call this a bell-shaped curve or Gaussian curve or different kinds of shapes, right? But if we were to measure every A molecule in solution, we would see some with very low energy, some with really high energy, but most of them are going to be around in this region right here that describes this bell-shaped curve, all right? And then if we look down to the next graph right here, we have energy plotted versus non-catalyzed reaction. Okay, and we're going to look at reactants and products. And we see on this diagram right here what molecules have a higher energy. Is it reactants or products? Reactants or products have a higher energy? the reactants, right, just by looking at this graph right here. And so as the reaction proceeds from reactants to products, for instance, when A and B are combined to produce C and D, so C and D would be down over here, all right, with a non-catalyzed reaction, we see that, all right, the products have a lower energy, the reactants have a higher energy, but in order for reactants to roll down the hill, all right, what do they have to get over? A little activation energy barrier, all right, so something has to, like, boost the energy of these reactants right here before the reaction can actually take place. All right, but now, do these reactants want to roll down the hill? They absolutely want to, but they just can't because there's this energy barrier right here. So actually, when I look at this diagram, I think of a car that I had when I was in college. It was a nice 1968 MGB, which is about this big, had a little four-cylinder engine, and it was really old, so during the course of a semester, frequently the battery would be dead or the starter motor would be out or there'd be a wire loose and the ignition wouldn't work, okay? And that was a bit of a problem, but with a little car like that, nice stick shift, what could I always do to get it started? I could park it on a hill, right? And then just give it a little push with my big toe and it would start rolling down the hill, pop the clutch, right? And away I could go. All right, but now if I didn't want my car, so that energy of rolling down the hill would get my car started. But sometimes I didn't want it to roll down the hill, so what could I do? I could put like a rock or something in front of the tire, and that way it wouldn't start rolling down the hill. All right, so that was an activation energy barrier. If I had that little brick in front of the front tire, does my car still want to roll down the hill? Absolutely, it's just that little brick is preventing it from going, okay? And so that's what this activation energy barrier is. All right, so one way to make this reaction proceed is by reducing the activation energy barrier, by introducing some kind of catalyst. And it could be a biological catalyst, for instance, like an enzyme. And in so doing, the activation energy barrier is reduced, so it takes less energy for reactants to combine to produce products right here. All right, so the activation energy is reduced in the second circumstance when a catalyst is available compared to when a catalyst is not available in this first circumstance right here. So what a catalyst does is that it increases, that we see on this the second graph over here, number of reactant molecules versus energy of reactants. What a catalyst does, it increases the number of reactants that have sufficient energy to get over this activation energy barrier. When the catalyst is there, this barrier decreases, so you have more molecules that have the potential to hop over this barrier. Okay, so that's what any kind of catalyst does. It speeds up the rate of the reaction, and it does so by increasing the number of reactants that have the sufficient energy to jump over some kind of activation energy barrier. Okay. So, let's compare the non-catalyzed with the catalyzed reaction in terms of this energy barrier. What is the energy of reactants, all right, that we see over here in the non-catalyzed reaction compared to, let's just say, the average energy of reactants in the non-catalyzed reaction compared to the catalyzed reaction? What's the average energy? I see a level right here. It's not labeled on the diagram, but can you tell it's exactly the same? Okay, the average energy is exactly the same. And what about the energy of the products? It's exactly the same as well, right? So the energy of the reactants and products stay exactly the same, right, from the non-catalyzed and catalyzed reaction. And as a matter of fact, the energy difference, all right, the energy released by the reaction signified by, what does that look like, yellow or gold or something? What's the length of this gold arrow from the non-catalyzed compared to the catalyzed reaction? They're exactly the same. So the energy released is exactly the same. What is the only thing that changes? The activation energy. That's right. So an enzyme doesn't make a reaction more favorable thermodynamically. Right, it keeps the thermodynamics exactly the same. The amount of energy released is exactly the same. It only changes the activation energy for a particular reaction. That's a pretty important concept to be aware of. And it does so by increasing by reducing this activation energy, which then increases the number of molecules that have sufficient energy to get over that barrier right there. Okay. All right, so the ability of enzymes to lower energy requirement is due to the structure of an enzyme, okay, or of a catalyst. Enzymes have a highly ordered three-dimensional shape. We call that the conformation or configuration of that particular protein. And on the surface of these proteins that we call enzymes, they have pockets that we call active sites, right, in which the reactants can actually fit into. So in order for, if you have a nice triangular-shaped reactant, right, then the shape of that active site has to be triangular so that it can match up. So the active site has to be complementary in shape. And maybe some hydrogen bonding or other kinds of van der Waals forces are necessary as well. They have to match up exactly. All right, so enzymes lower the activation energy by bringing substrates close together so they can react. So think of these two markers. I think I have a green and a red one right here. So let's consider these the reactants A and B. They're going to come together to form a product, which is a red-green molecule, just in that order. All right? But in order to get a red-green molecule, they have to fit together exactly just like this. But if we bring these markers together, how many different ways can we bring them together to where they won't form a product? How about if we bring them together like that? Does that form a product? No, they're going to fall apart. What about if we bring them together like this? They're not going to form a product. Or like that. Or like this. Or like this. How many different ways can we bring these two markers together to not form a product? Probably millions of different ways. How many ways do these markers have to be brought together to form a product? Yeah, just in this one way, just like that, out of millions, right? So if you don't have an enzyme or a catalyst, these molecules are bumping into each other all the time, but a product won't form because they don't bump into each other the right way. But with an enzyme, the substrates bind to the enzyme. The enzyme brings them together in exactly the right way, so you get red-green, just like that. All right, so you get one primary product, as a matter of fact, and then you don't even get green-red. Right, you don't get the reverse. So enzymes are really nice because they give you the exact product that you need, that your body needs, right? Because of the active sites, bringing substrates together just in the right way so that the perfect product is always formed. All right, so that takes away a lot of that futile bumping into that never even produces a product or an improper product as well. All right, so how do we know something about enzymes? All right, so here we have an enzyme, and here we have a couple substrates, A and B. Here are the active sites, or the pockets on the surface of the enzyme. So A can fit into this active site, B can fit into this one, and B can't fit into the active site for A because why? It doesn't have the right shape, right? So it just won't fit in here. All right, so when substrate A and B bind to its respective active sites, that forms a complex that we call the enzyme-substrate complex. And the enzyme-substrate complex has to form before any products can form. That's a necessary and obligatory step in this process right here. All right, and then since the products are brought together in exactly the right way to produce the reaction, then the products are produced, and then when the products are produced, they're released from the active sites, and then your cells have the proper product that it needs to maintain homeostasis. All right, now what can you tell me about, so here is, what is this molecule right here? That's the enzyme, because it's labeled right over here. What's the difference between the enzyme after the reaction compared to the enzyme before the reaction? What about the color? Exactly the same. What about the shape? Exactly the same. And the size? Exactly the same, right? So this enzyme right here is not altered by the chemical reaction. What are the things that are altered? The substrates go away, and what's produced? The products, exactly right. Okay, but the enzyme is there to keep this reaction going over and over and over again. All right. Okay, let's talk about naming enzymes. In modern nomenclature, enzymes are given the name with an A-S-E suffix at the end of the word. Okay, and there are various classes of enzymes, and we're going to be using these classes all the time, like a phosphatase removes a phosphate group, and you kind of have a picture in your mind what a phosphate group looks like, because that was one of the little figures you had to know for the exam. It's what, a PO4, an inorganic phosphate functional group. All right, so a phosphatase removes that inorganic phosphate group from another molecule. A kinase is one that adds a phosphate, and that phosphate usually comes from ATP, so that when something is phosphorylated, it also has a lot of available energy released when that happens. Okay? And then, more modern terminology, substrates or enzymes are actually named after the substrate, for instance, that they are using in the chemical reaction. And sometimes even the type of reaction that is taking place. So, for instance, when we look at lactate dehydrogenase, what's the first thing that we recognize right away? Okay. I see, according to this first principle right here, you have an ASE, so you're clued in that it's an enzyme. Okay. And then the second thing I see is here is a substrate, lactate. That's exactly the same thing as lactic acid. We're going to look at that in the next chapter, maybe next time in class. All right, and dehydrogenase is the kind of dehydrogen is the kind of reaction that it produces in the body. Okay, so it's a reduction type reaction, which we're going to look at in this chapter. So there is a lot of information in the name as long as you know the nomenclature that's involved. Okay, so ASE at the end of a word. Here are some important enzymes that are found in living cells. Some of these are in your body. For instance, here is catalase, and catalase is an older kind of nomenclature, but you still know it's what? Because of this ASE right here. It's an enzyme, all right? And in all likelihood, what kind of molecule is catalase going to be? A protein, a lipid, a carbohydrate, or a nucleic acid? It's going to be a protein, right? Because 99.9%, as far as we know right now, are proteins. We know of some nucleic acids that can act as enzymes, but most are proteins because they can develop the right kind of shape. Right? Catalase can break down H2O2. Does anybody know what H2O2 is? Maybe some people do. It's called hydrogen peroxide, and most of us have some of this laying around the house in a bottle, a nice really dark bottle, and we keep it in a medicine cabinet, keep it out of sunlight. Okay. And hydrogen peroxide, right, when we pour it on a wound, is subjected to catalase, or a series of enzymes that are very similar to catalase, and hydrogen peroxide then breaks down very quickly into water and oxygen, and you put that on a wound, and that water irrigates the wound, it kind of flushes out bacteria, and a lot of bacteria are sensitive to oxygen concentration. It's a kind of a poison to them, so this is a nice way of more or less disinfecting the wound and cleaning a wound up, for instance. All right. But now, if we were to keep that hydrogen peroxide in that bottle in your bathroom for 30 years, guess what's going to happen to that hydrogen peroxide? It's going to break down all by itself. What does this enzyme catalase do? It speeds up the reaction that would happen normally anyway, right? So if it wasn't in a dark bottle and you were to keep it in a window with sunlight, then that hydrogen peroxide would break down very rapidly. Not as much as if there was an enzyme around, but it still would break down very rapidly. Okay, so that's an important consideration. Remember, enzyme can't make a reaction occur that won't happen, but it can just speed up the rate of a reaction that eventually will. Here's another important enzyme. It's called carbonic anhydrase. It can take carbonic acid, which is H2CO3, and convert it into water and carbon dioxide. This is a crucial enzyme and reaction in your body because what of these chemicals that you see right here, carbonic acid, water, and CO2, right, there's probably one that you recognize your body is producing all the time, and that is CO2, right? And this reaction right here is a way of taking CO2 and converting it into a compound that's very soluble in your body, and then your body can deal with this carbon dioxide that's being produced all the time. So this is another important chemical reaction and enzyme that's in your body. Amylase, again, you can see is a is an enzyme. It can take starch. What's the building block of starch? Glucose. right? So it can chop two glucose monomers off at a time, right? And it's going to produce water and maltose, and maltose is just a disaccharide with glucose being the building block. Lactate dehydrogenase can convert lactic acid into pyruvic acid and produce some hydrogens as well. We're going to look at that reaction really, really soon, right? And ribonuclease, this is a little bit more modern nomenclature. We see the ASE at the end, so we know it is an enzyme, right? But what's a ribonucleotide? Yeah, it's a nucleic acid. What's it good for? Is it good for anything? Yeah, it's good for making what? DNA and RNA, right? Yeah, if it was deoxyribo nucleic acid, then it would be making DNA or RNA. Here is an enzyme that breaks down DNA and RNA. Okay, so that, for instance, if a foreign cell gets inside your body, like a bacteria, which has its own DNA and RNA, then these enzymes will then destroy that particle so that it's not infectious anymore. So these are important enzymes that restrict the kinds of information that's contained in your body. All right, so RNA plus water, okay, will be broken down into ribonucleotides, or DNA plus water can be broken down into deoxyribonucleotides. So here are some important enzymes that we're going to spend a bunch of time with. All right, so enzyme activity is the rate at which these reactants are converted into products. And when we're talking about enzyme-catalyzed reactions, all right, we sometimes substitute substrates for the word reactant right here. All right, so a substrate will be converted into products. And sometimes we even put substrates on either side of the equation because sometimes it's a bidirectional reaction. It can go back one, it could go forwards or backwards. All right, but on this slide, I want you to know that a rate is the conversion of reactants into products, or you could say substrates into products. All right, enzyme activity is dependent on a number of parameters. For instance, temperature and pH are two important parameters, but also maybe salt concentration, because as the salt concentration changes inside the cell, the conformation of an enzyme is going to change, which is exactly what happens when you change the temperature or pH of a solution. The shape of the enzyme changes a little bit. And when the shape of the enzyme changes, what would you expect? Then the function of that enzyme is going to change, right? It's going to speed up or slow down the rate of that chemical reaction that it's catalyzing. All right, enzymes have an optimal temperature and pH range for performing their function, right? It's typically near normal physiologic values, right? But we find a couple of places in our body that are way beyond a physiological pH. Can anybody name a part of your body that's way beyond the normal physiologic pH, which is what, 7.35, 7.45 in blood, for instance? And the stomach has a pH of around 2, maybe 1 to 2. It's highly acidic, right? That will denature most proteins, but some enzymes that function in the stomach need that pH to work. They don't assume the right conformation unless they are at that particular pH. Right, and the same thing for temperature. Let's look at a graph of enzyme activity versus temperature. Remember, enzyme activity is what? It's just the rate of how products are produced versus time, okay, or for a certain period of time. And if we look at this graph, starting with kind of cold temperatures, as we increase the temperature of a solution that contains an enzyme and substrate, what happens to the rate? It increases and it increases, and it looks kind of nice and linear in this region right here, and then it kind of levels off into this plateau region, and then right when we get to around 40 degrees, all of a sudden it plummets down, right? And if we were to continue this graph, we'd see that it actually goes to zero. Because what's happening? What kind of molecule is an enzyme once again? It's a protein, right? And that protein has to have the right shape. And as we increase the temperature, what happens to molecular motion? Because of Brownian motion, everything gets mixed up faster and faster. The enzyme even starts to wiggle and vibrate and change shape a little bit. All right, so we would expect as the temperature to increase because of that mixing function, the rate to increase because substrates are going to be bouncing into the enzyme more frequently as the temperature increases. But once we get to this temperature right here, the enzyme or that protein starts to wiggle and bend so much that it's going to snap, okay, and change its conformation. And when it changes its conformation, what happens to the active site? It changes, it gets destroyed, so now substrates can't bind to an active site because there's no longer one there. And if the active site is gone, what can't form? What can't form if the active site is gone? The enzyme substrate complex can't form, and if the enzyme substrate complex can't form, neither can the products, all right? So that's why it's really important for you to have, like, burned into your mind this picture right here of this enzyme substrate complex. Anything that disturbs this enzyme substrate complex is going to decrease the rate of this catalyzed reaction. All right. The other thing is, too, what happens if now we bring this protein, if we start to cool the protein back down to 30 or 37 degrees, is the activity going to come back? On this graph, it kind of looks like it, but you should all realize that it doesn't. And probably you should all be really familiar with that because maybe tonight you're going to go home and cook a nice hamburger on the grill, right? So you get some raw hamburger out of your refrigerator and put it on the grill and it cooks. What happens to the hamburger? Does it look the same after it's cooked? Totally different, right? The texture changes. And then you're about ready to sit down and eat that hamburger, but then you get a call from me saying, hey, I'm down at the local pool hall and we got three people shooting pool and we need a fourth person. We want you to come down and shoot pool with us. And of course, you're going to say, well, of course, I'm not going to miss an opportunity to shoot pool with everybody. So you take your cooked hamburger and put it back in the refrigerator. Does it ever become raw hamburger again? No, because that process is irreversible, right? So that's what we call denaturation. Once a protein is denatured, we can't get it back to its native conformation or native configuration, even though we decrease the temperature because the active site is destroyed. Okay. Other enzymes that we see right here have different optimal pHs. So here's a plot of enzyme activity versus pH. And we see, for instance, pepsin that works in the stomach has an optimal pH right around 2, which is the pH inside your stomach. To break a peptide bond, it's necessary to have fairly extremes in pH to break that peptide bond. It's a very strong kind of bond. All right, so pepsin will help hydrolyze proteins, and then that material moves from the stomach into the small intestine, and then the pH shifts way to the other end of this pH scale by adding buffers, okay, to it. And trypsin, for instance, is another protease. What's a substrate for a protease? It's a part of the name. Yeah, a protein, right? And what's the substrate for a lipase? A lipid, right? Okay, so trypsin is an example, a specific example of a protease. And again, it can only work at a very high pH or an alkaline pH or basic pH near 10. All right, so if we were to plot out enzyme activity versus pH, these are the activities that we would see for pepsin in the stomach, trypsin in the small intestine, and salivary amylase is right around pH 7, right? Because through evolution in your mouth, the pH is about 7. So this is the pH that salivary amylases can optimally convert, okay, polysaccharides into monosaccharides. All right, and that's all based on the three-dimensional structure of these proteins because there has to be an active site in order to form the enzyme substrate complex. All right, so here are a bunch of other enzymes, and you can tell because they all have an ASE on the end of them. Pepsin, you know, in the stomach, phosphatase, acid phosphatase. You should probably memorize, what does a phosphatase do? A phosphatase removes a phosphate group, okay? And what's the reverse reaction? What's the opposite reaction? What's the name of an enzyme that can catalyze the opposite reaction? Yeah, that kinase. All right, so it's really important because in anatomy, we learned about, for instance, antagonistic muscles. Biceps, what's antagonistic to the biceps? Triceps. What's the job of the biceps? Flexion of the forearm, and the job of the triceps is extension. Okay, so here you have two opposing kinds of functions. Now, is that a benefit to you or is that harmful to you to have two mechanisms that work in opposition to each other? Oh, that's a really good thing to have, right? Antagonism in terms of control systems is very important, right? So tonight on the way home from work or whatever, you get pulled over by that person in the fancy blue uniform and the badge and sidearm, and they say, I want you to put your index finger on the tip of your nose with your eyes closed. All right, I cheated. I kept my eyes open. Okay. But they're going to look and see, and you need to have what? Antagonistic control of that fingertip so that you have precise control and balance over it. If you only had a biceps and not a triceps, what would happen to your index finger? Well, you might poke the officer in the eye or yourself in the eye, and then you'd have a really long discussion, right? So antagonism is very important. Here is, in terms of enzyme activity, an important study in antagonism, because a phosphatase and a kinase are antagonistic to each other, but because in your body you have phosphatases and kinases working in opposition, you have precise control and balance over a number of important metabolic pathways and other kinds of chemical reactions taking place in your body. So antagonism is real important. Okay, here is another phosphatase over here. All right, so I think that's all I'm going to say about this slide. I don't expect you to memorize the optimal pH, but you should realize that there is a difference in different enzymes depending on where they are acting in the body and what's required of them. Okay, cofactors and coenzymes. Some of these molecules are small. Some are compounds. They're very large, right? And in any case, they are necessary for normal activity of the enzymes. They have to be present in order for enzymes to do their job. All right, so let's define what a cofactor is and what a coenzyme is, at least for the purposes of this course. Other courses might redefine these things for you. Some laboratories might agree with these definitions and some won't, but for this class, this is the key that we're going to use for a cofactor. All right, a cofactor is a small metal ion, okay? For instance, like a calcium or magnesium. What's Mn? Manganese, right? That's an ion. Copper and zinc and selenium. Oh, why didn't they put the selenium right here? Did I have you know that one? Probably not. I don't know if that was on, that probably wasn't on the list. All right. So these are small elements. These are not compounds, right? These are just ions. Most of them are divalent cations. And they have to be present in order for a chemical reaction to take place. All right? And without these ions being present, then a chemical reaction won't take place. Your body won't be able to maintain homeostasis. All right, so where do you know calcium is important? In bones, to make bones strong. But now you know that calcium is important to help allow certain kinds of chemical reactions to take place. It's a cofactor. Okay, and we're going to talk about some of those reactions throughout the whole class, and then you'll have to make up your mind, where is it important for you personally to have the proper levels of calcium? Is it in your bones, or is it in other organs where calcium is necessary? Okay, and then we'll see why your body makes the choice that it does. A coenzyme, on the other hand, and this is easy to remember, look at this term right here, enzyme. What is an enzyme? Is it an organic molecule or an inorganic molecule? It's organic, has carbon, right, and has hydrogens, and it has nitrogens and all these other kinds of compounds, right? But what's calcium, magnesium, and manganese? Are these organic or inorganic? These are all inorganic materials, right? So an enzyme is a protein. A coenzyme is going to be an organic molecule as well, right? So that's really handy in this term. So coenzymes are derived from vitamins, and vitamins are organic molecules. They're not just metal ions, right? And they're used to transport things from one chemical reaction to another. And this term right here transports small molecules needed by enzymes. So they will maybe carry a little participating molecule and then deliver it someplace, let it go so that it can participate in a chemical reaction. All right, but these are going to, so a coenzyme is relatively large. It's actually huge compared to these metal cations right here. They're organic, and their job is just to transfer material from one set of chemical reactions to another. You could even almost think of it as like a transfer RNA, and a transfer RNA could be considered a coenzyme as a result of that. Okay, so let's look at this slide right here, cofactors and coenzymes. Cofactors, when they bind, it changes the conformation of the active site. Okay, so for instance, here we have an enzyme, and here we have a couple substrates. And this cofactor, now what the heck is a cofactor? A large organic molecule or a small metal ion? Yeah, it's a small metal ion, and it has a charge on it, so it's going to bind to some charged region. It's going to produce a nice ionic bond someplace on this molecule right here. So here we have a cofactor. It can bind to one of two places. It can bind to a site on the enzyme that is far away from the active site. But when it binds, right, that's like your friend poking you in the side, you're going to change conformation. It changes the conformation of the enzyme protein, so now that the active site has the proper configuration to accept these substrates. And when it does, you can see then that the substrates will fit together perfectly to produce a product, right, as a result. A cofactor can not only bind on the surface of the enzyme at a site other than the active site, it can actually bind within the active site someplace. And when it does, it allows, right, the active site to match up in a complementary fashion exactly so that the substrates can bind. Okay? And then if we have an enzyme substrate complex that we have right here, what will form? Product will form. Right? But without this cofactor binding within the active site, you don't have the enzyme substrate complex forming, or if it doesn't bind to this exterior site right here, you don't have a competent enzyme substrate complex forming. Products won't be formed as a result of that. So these little cofactors are important to make sure that the active sites have the right shape to accept these substrates for binding. All right, many enzymes are produced in an inactive form. A good example of that would be some digestive enzymes that are produced in the pancreas. Right? They're not produced in an active form, which is really good. Why is that? Yeah, because then it would digest the pancreas away. And that does happen, and it's really a terrible situation to call that pancreatitis or pancreatic cancer. Can activate digestive enzymes in the pancreas, and it's really difficult to treat. Right, because the pancreas actually starts digesting itself, and that produces more digestive enzymes, which digest the pancreas even more, which produces more digestive enzymes. So what kind of feedback loop is that? That's a positive feedback loop that rarely ends in anything that maintains homeostasis, right? So that's a terrible situation that happens. So these digestive enzymes are produced in an inactive form. Then they get into a duct. So this is the exocrine function of the pancreas. They're emptied into the pancreatic duct that then carries those precursor enzymes to where does the pancreatic duct go? You probably had to draw it out in anatomy. Where does it go? Ventricle in the brain? No. Small intestine, right in the duodenum, proximal part of the duodenum, okay, where then many are phosphorylated, okay. And when they're phosphorylated, what kind of enzyme is going to phosphorylate some of these enzymes? Yeah, it would be a kinase. Yeah, and you could use phosphorylase. People certainly would know what you're talking about, but usually we say kinase, and they become active. Others are dephosphorylated. You would use a phosphatase to remove a phosphate from that protein. Again, if these phosphate groups are pretty big, they're going to cause changes in the conformation of these proteins, which will then activate or inactivate them. They can be used as switches depending on the usefulness inside your body. Okay. Others are activated by ligands, small molecules that we call second messengers. So a ligand is something that binds to a protein, and it's a relatively small molecule. And I'm kind of thinking cofactor, but not exactly. It doesn't have to be a cofactor. Just any other kind of molecule, all right, that will bind, for instance, maybe to a receptor would be a good way of thinking of it. Right? And so there can be, we're going to talk about many different kinds of ligands that bind to other molecules that change the physiology inside the cell. All right. And the way that we think of enzymes, we can characterize them kind of like how we characterized receptors before. The rate of product formation increases as the substrate concentration increases. So here we have a nice plot of the rate of a reaction versus substrate concentration. Remember, we had a graph that looked similar to this when we looked at membrane transport. All right, and what we have right here is a substrate has to match up to the active site on the enzyme. So maybe we have one substrate over here. Right, and we have thousands of enzymes that can convert that substrate into products. So in then if we add two substrates to that concentration, what happens to the rate? It basically doubles. And then if we add three substrate molecules, then it triples, right? But then all of a sudden, if we start adding like 1,500 substrate molecules to that solution, now you have more substrate than you have enzyme, and what happens to all that substrate? It's got to wait around until there's some availability to find an active site on an enzyme someplace. So this reaction rate can't go on forever increasing. It levels off because at this point right here that we call saturation, all the active sites on all the available enzymes that are in that solution are occupied by substrate. Right, so all the substrate that's not bound to the enzyme can't produce any products because the enzyme substrate doesn't form with them. All right, so that's what we call saturation. The other thing that we noticed with enzyme-catalyzed reactions, they're very specific. That means only molecules that have the right shape and size fit onto the active site, just like membrane transporters. And if you have maybe two molecules like A and Z, they have kind of similar shape, they will compete with each other for those active sites as well. So if we had more than one molecule with the right shape, then the level of the saturation level would decrease right here. Okay, let's look at some reversible reactions. And in this particular case, we have water and carbon dioxide going to form carbonic acid. And probably if you memorize the formula right here for carbonic acid, that probably would be a good thing, though I don't think I test you specifically on that, but I think this is such an important reaction, it's probably good to know, because this is going to lead us to another compound, another derivative of carbonic acid called bicarbonate ion. Okay, has anybody heard of bicarbonate before? Probably some of you have experienced some life in a hospital or clinic or something. That's a real important molecule for maintaining homeostasis. But let's just start with this one right here. And when you look at this chemical reaction, what can you tell me? Does it like to go to the right or to the left? It actually can go either way. Okay, it's a bidirectional, and that's because the energy of water and carbon dioxide, if you add them together, is equal to the energy of carbonic acid. So there's no big energy change one way or the other. So this is a bidirectional reaction, right? So an enzyme is still necessary to make this reaction happen quickly inside your body, but it can go in either direction. It can go forward or it can go in the reverse direction. Right? We call that the law of mass action. It's also called, maybe in chemistry, does anybody else know what this law is called? It determines which way the reaction will proceed, whether from left to right or from right to left. Law of mass action, or in chemistry, they like to call, and I like to call it, and when I say it, you're going to laugh because I can't speak in French, but it's called Le Chatelier's principle. Okay? And Le Chatelier's principle just says that if we decrease the concentration of water or decrease the concentration of CO2, the reaction is going to move to the left. If we increase the concentration of CO2, the reaction is going to proceed to the right. So it all depends on, right, the balance of, or the concentration of these chemicals. So let's just see if you're tracking with me. Which way is the reaction going to go if we decrease the concentration of carbonic acid? Decrease carbonic acid in solution. Which way is it going to go? It's going to go to the right. So water and carbon dioxide are going to combine to kind of build up the concentration of carbonic acid that you took out of solution. Okay? Or if we add carbonic acid, it's going to force the reaction to the left. And you got to know the name of this enzyme. And I mentioned it before a couple of previous slides. It is carbonic anhydrase. So carbonic anhydrase makes this reaction zip back and forth all the time, maintaining balance inside your body. All right, so this is a nice reversible reaction. And that energy that I was talking about is called the Gibbs free energy. Did you talk about Gibbs free energy yet in lab? Maybe a little bit? Okay. All right, so sometimes we want to put the Gibbs free energy into this equation right here, actually write it out, but it would be the same on both sides of the equation, which means what? It would cancel out. So we don't really write it in this particular reaction that we see right here. All right. Le Chatelier's principle, or the law of mass action. Let's talk about some metabolic pathways. So here we have an enzyme reaction where you have a substrate, it's converted into products, like what I have on the board right here. And this reaction, all right, is this going to take forever to happen, or is it going to be speedy, and why? It's going to be speedy, because what do you see on this diagram? I see an enzyme, right? That's exactly right. So this is going to happen very quickly. All right, and when B is produced, then it's going to be converted into C. And how fast is that going to be? And again, it's going to be fast because we have enzymes right here. All right, so we don't have just one chemical reaction. We have a series of steps of chemical reactions that will eventually produce a final product that we're going to call F. So A is converted to B, to C, to D, E, and then finally to F. So if we have a series of chemical reactions, right, and the conversion of E to F is dependent on how much D is produced, right, dependent on how much C is produced, and dependent on how much B is produced, this is what we call a metabolic pathway, because it requires a number of enzymes and a number of different chemical steps in order to produce F. So F can't be made from A. There's got to be a number of steps in here. These different substrates and products along the way, like B, C, D, and E, are what we call intermediates in a metabolic pathway. And all of these enzymes are going to be different, right? Because the shape of B is going to be different than the shape of C, and C is going to be different than the shape of D. So these enzymes, 2, 3, and 4, have to be different because the shape of these substrates are different. Okay, let's look at the next slide. Here's a pretty important concept, end product inhibition. So I see A, through a number of different steps, can produce a number of different intermediates like B, C, D, and E, and then finally F over here. What do we call this thing right here? That's a nice metabolic pathway, exactly right. Okay, and each one of these steps is catalyzed by a different enzyme. But over here, I see what? A second metabolic pathway starting at C. This right here, C can either be converted into D or can be converted into D prime depending on which of these enzymes is active. All right? If they're both active at the same time, then you're going to make equal amounts of F and F prime. But if only enzyme 3 is active, only F is going to be made. If enzyme 3 is deactivated and enzyme 3 prime is activated, then your body is going to make F prime. Right? So this is right here, C, the conversion of C to either D or D prime, this is what we call a branch point. All right, so a branch point is an important control feature in metabolic pathways, right? So label that. Nice branch point right here. And in this particular example, we see that when F prime builds up, right, the concentration builds up in solution, and it can bump into enzyme 3 prime right here, and maybe it's going to bump into it at a place other than the active site. And when it binds to that enzyme, that's like a friend poking you in the side, what's going to happen to the shape of that enzyme? It's going to change conformation. So now the active site is distorted. All right, so what about substrate C? Can it bind to enzyme 3 prime if the active site is distorted? It can't bind. So this pathway is going to be shut down. And the top pathway is then going to take over and produce F. All right, so as the concentration of F prime increases, then this metabolic pathway is inhibited from making more F prime. So that kind of acts as a nice negative feedback loop, which maintains only the proper level of F prime, not an overabundance of F prime in a cell. But that seed isn't wasted. What happens to C? It's diverted to another important metabolic pathway in your body to produce other important products. Yeah. Yeah, it can be reversed. For instance, when your body uses up F prime, okay, and then F prime is going to dissociate from this enzyme, and when it dissociates from the enzyme, it becomes activated again, and then this lower pathway opens up and it makes more F prime, maintaining homeostasis. So this is not a denaturing effect, okay, so this is a nice active regulatory mechanism. We call this allosteric inhibition, right, if it binds to a site other than the active site. All right, so that maintains F prime in the proper concentration within normal range to produce homeostasis in the body. Okay, and so allosteric inhibition happens where? At a branch point in a metabolic pathway. So that C doesn't build up inside the cell, C is used to make other kinds of important product that your body needs. All right, we haven't talked about bioenergetics yet, so let's start talking about this. Okay, we've got a couple laws of thermodynamics that we're going to look at. Okay, but bioenergetics refers to the flow of energy in living systems. The first law just says, right, that energy can be transformed from one form to another, but can't be created or destroyed. So another cosmic way of thinking of this is that the total amount of energy in our universe is constant, right? And energy can be converted from one form or the other, but it can't be created or destroyed. So what are some different forms of energy that we're used to dealing with? Okay, light has energy, yeah. Light has energy. And some of my favorite organisms can use light as an energy source. Okay. What's another form of energy? Heat. Yeah, heat is a form of energy. It's a measure of energy. There's chemical energy. For instance, there's chemical energy and mechanical energy. Hopefully none of you have really experienced mechanical energy too severely, right? Because it has a tendency to damage cytoplasm when you get too much mechanical energy applied to your body at one particular time. But I'm thinking of a particular engine that can convert chemical energy to mechanical energy. Okay, yeah, your car, your engine in your car. It can take in gasoline, right? And then it rearranges that gasoline, converts it into CO2 and water. And when that happens, it releases a lot of energy and it makes the pistons move up and down. So that chemical energy in gasoline is used to make the pistons move up and down. That's a mechanical energy, which is coupled with other mechanical mechanisms in your car to transfer that to the wheels on your car, and you can get from home to school, thank goodness. All right. Light is a form of energy, right? And we have receptors in our eyes that can take light energy, convert it into electrochemical energy, nerve impulses that go to our brain. All right, so this, the amount of energy is still there, it's just been converted from one form to another. All right, so there are different ways of converting energy. We can take electrical energy and run it through a filament in a light bulb so that it gets heated up and it's going to emit light. All right, so you take that electrical energy, convert it into light energy. So that certainly does obey the first law of thermodynamics. I could probably think of some other ones. Oh, what do plants do? That's a nice one. It takes light energy and converts it into chemical energy. It can take carbon dioxide and put chemical carbon dioxide molecules together to make a nice sugar molecule. All right, so it can convert light energy into chemical energy. That's really handy. And I'm very jealous of plants. Right? I would be green if I could do that, but no one has figured out how to do that. But it would be nice to sit on a beach all day long, and what would that be like doing? Drinking a milkshake all day long, okay? Because that's what plants do. They make glucose, right? Okay. Yeah. But we can't do that. All right. Second law states that energy transformations increase entropy in order for the chemical reaction to take place. And entropy is a degree of disorganization of a system. Okay, so whenever there is some kind of chemical reaction, all right, entropy has to increase, which means something gets disorganized. And you might be thinking, well, gee whiz, that doesn't really happen in me, because when I take an energy, I don't become more disorganized. I see more structure. I grow. I see more cells, more chromosomes, right, and contraction of muscles. But when you take an energy to organize your body, it's producing heat, and what do you do with that heat? You don't keep it inside your body. That heat is a very disorganizing function, right? So it moves from your body to the atmosphere, and that causes a lot of random motion in the atmosphere. It increases the temperature of the atmosphere, right? And if you were to add up all of that disorganization compared to the organizing ability of that energy, you'd see that that disorganization far outweighs how much your body is organizing molecules inside your body, okay? So you can only be organized if something else becomes even more disorganized, like the air around you when it picks up that heat. Right? And only free energy, energy in an organized state, can be used to do work, like energy that's trapped in a crystal of sugar on your table. It's highly organized, and then you can take that crystal of sugar in, disorganize it, and organize your body as a result. All right, so systems have a tendency to go from states of high free energy to states of low free energy. That's really the only way things work. Those are the first two laws of bioenergetics. So let's apply that to some systems that we're familiar with. Oh, did we pass the sign-in sheet around? Oh, we did. Good. It's maybe in the back of the room, just on a regular line piece of paper. Okay, so second law says that living organisms require continual input of energy. Otherwise, you're going to become disorganized, right? So you need energy to stay organized. Plants obtain that from sunlight. So here we have energy diagram. So here we have like Gibbs free energy on this vertical scale over here, and the horizontal scale shows various kinds of structures. Right? It's not really a nice scale. But we can have the sun, and what energy is the sun at? Really high energy, right? So it's really high up on this scale right here. Yeah, we have sunlight, and you got to take a couple physics classes to know something about all this energy and where it comes from and all that stuff, like a bandwidth and the different colors in sunlight, okay? But that sunlight reaches Earth, right, and its energy, and it can be used by this plant right here. And what colors does this plant absorb? Everything but green. Green is reflected back to you, so your eyes see that green, but it's taking in, it's absorbing that blue energy and yellow energy and red energy, for instance. And when it takes in that energy, it can also then take in carbon dioxide and water and combine these together. If we take six CO2s, it can combine it to make a carbohydrate, right? Like, for instance, glucose. So now this energy, which was chemical energy, now has been converted into chemical energy, or energy from the sun, which is light energy, can be converted into chemical energy. And in that process of doing it, this water is broken down, and then plants secrete or excrete what compound? Oxygen. Okay. So what can you tell me about CO2 if you look at this? Is it an excretory product or is it an essential nutrient? It's an essential nutrient that plants need in order to make glucose, right? All right, so then this glucose is available to maintain the structure in this plant, and then if we eat the plant, we get the glucose, and what can we do? We can use that glucose to run our bodies and maintain the structure of our bodies as a result. So what has a higher free energy, carbon dioxide and water or glucose? Glucose, and this is a much more highly organized system. Glucose is much more highly organized compared to these 12 separate molecules of CO2 and water, right? So this is that highly organized system that can be used to do work. All right, so we've been talking about energy, but what the heck is energy? I just said it in the last statement. That's what triggered this question. What is energy? It's really hard to put your finger on it. Okay, but we should talk about it a little bit. When you have a lot of energy, what can you do? You can do a lot of work. And when you wake up in the morning and you feel like you don't have a lot of energy, you're not going to do a lot of work, right? So basically, that's how I want you to understand energy. Energy is the ability to do a lot of work. So if you have a lot of energy in the form of chemicals in your body, then your body can do a lot of work. If you're deficient in energy, you can't do a lot of work. Okay, let's talk about endergonic and exergonic reactions. All right, endergonic reactions require input of energy to proceed. So energy has to come from someplace. The products contain more free energy than the reactants. All right, so if we look at this chemical reaction right here, and if we were going to say, let's see if I can figure this out, how about if we say endergonic? Endergonic reaction, and we're going to take this physical entity, which again is kind of abstract. We're going to put energy on this diagram. Which side of the equation are we going to put this energy? Okay, endergonic. Endergonic means it's going to require energy, right? So we're going to put energy where? Right here. Energy plus A and B, and then you'll be able to make those products. So where did this energy go to? It's now contained in these products right here. So that's why we say in an endergonic reaction, the reactants have less energy than the products do because you had to add energy to get this chemical reaction to take place. So think of energy as like being a molecule. It's not a molecule, but it's still a real physical entity. All right, so can I erase this right now? Probably, if I had an eraser. There's one. All right, so let's go back to our standard equation right here. Now, if this is an exergonic reaction, exergonic, all right, which means what? Exergonic means it's going to release energy when the reaction takes place. So what side of the equation do we want it on, left or right? We want it on the right side, so here we have energy over here. That's an exergonic reaction. Okay. So in this particular case, and remember because of the first law of thermodynamics, the energy over here has to equal the energy over there. What has more energy, the products or reactants? The reactants have more energy in this particular case. So you could draw it out on a scale like we see right here, energy versus different substrate molecules in a reaction. Okay. So let's look at this one. We have glucose and oxygen being converted into some intermediates, and these intermediates have less free energy as it proceeds through this metabolic pathway all the way down to CO2 and water. All right, so what kind of reaction is this when CO2 is converted into this first intermediate? We don't even have to name what this first intermediate is. Okay. We see what? It is producing energy, so what kind of reaction is this that's releasing energy? That's an exergonic reaction. All right, so because you have a lot of free energy in an exergonic reaction, you have more free energy in the reactants than the product, right, that releases energy that can be used to do other kinds of work. All right, so if we take glucose and burn it in your car, for instance, with combustion just in one step, that releases a lot of energy that might move the pistons up and down. But in biological systems, all right, that energy is released in small amounts, and then a lot of the energy can be harnessed to do the body's work. As opposed to in your car, what is the efficiency? Okay, has anybody ever touched your tailpipe on your car? Probably you know better than to do that. Because it's super hot, it would burn your fingers immediately, right? So only a very small portion of the energy that's in that gasoline actually is used to make the pistons go up and down. I think a gas engine is like only 40% efficient, which means when you stop at the gas station and pay $5 for gas, only about $1 of it goes into getting you from work to home, right? It's really inefficient because of that. But in a biological system, we have a number of different steps that becomes much more efficient than, for instance, an internal combustion engine. All right, but in each one of these cases, it releases a little bit of energy. And that energy can be used to do other kinds of things in your body, like, for instance, what? Muscle contraction or making ATP that can run pumps in your body, right? A number of different things. All right, so your body then produces CO2 and water as a result. The total amount of energy when you break down glucose into carbon dioxide is the same, whether it's through a multi-step process or just a one-step combustion process, right? It's just that this kind of process right here, more of the energy can be used to do organized work, and it can be regulated so that it's the work that you want to do. All right, so make sure you know some good definitions for endergonic and exergonic. Maybe do this equation right here, right, and consider energy a participant. coupled reactions, for instance, the production, for instance, of ATP. So cells require constant inputs of free energy from the environment, right, to stop the disorganization process that's normally going to happen inside your body. We call that entropy, right? So maintain highly organized, we need constant free energy to do that. And the cells do this by coupling endergonic reactions to exergonic reactions. An important exergonic reaction breaks down ATP. So what is this reaction? We would have ATP right here. How many phosphates are in adenosine triphosphate? There are three, right? And that can be broken down into ADP, which has two phosphates, right? Plus an inorganic phosphate, which is what, a PO4 group? right? And something else over here. We said this is an exergonic reaction. What's the third thing we want to put in there? Energy, right. So here we have energy. And because this is an exergonic reaction, we say that there is a lot of energy in ATP that can be used to run various processes inside your body. ATP is a nice universal energy carrier. There is a lot more energy in glucose than there is in ATP, but that energy in glucose can't be used universally by a number of energy-using processes in your body. Only ATP is. All right, so here's an interesting statement that we have to consider. Most exergonic reactions in the body make ATP, but using ATP is what? Exergonic. What does that mean? Okay, let's look at this little illustration right here. Here is sort of like a diagram, a plot of free energy versus some reactions that are taking place in your body, and these little wheels can turn. Right, so if we have reactants at a real high free energy, this reaction will take place automatically. It will produce products, but what about these products? Are they going to have a higher free energy or a lesser free energy if it's going to happen automatically? Lesser free energy, right? It's like kind of like water running down a hill. This wheel is going to turn. So this reaction will happen nice and spontaneously if it's an exergonic reaction, right? This exergonic reaction just doesn't spin inside your cells futilely, but it's coupled to other kinds of chemical reactions. And we see a little gear, right? So when this, blue? So when the blue wheel turns, and it's going to turn clockwise, what happens to this one that looks gray? Is it going to turn or just sit still? It's going to turn, and which way is it going to turn? The opposite way. So this little wheel right here can take reactants that are low free energy and make products that are at a high free energy. All right, so, and what kind of reaction do we call that? That's a nice endergonic reaction. That can't happen by itself unless it's coupled to some other reactions that are exergonic. Right? And in order for this to happen, the blue wheel has to be bigger than the gray wheel. If they were exactly the same size, then that reaction wouldn't happen. And for sure it wouldn't happen if the blue wheel was smaller than the gray wheel. Right? So there has to be more available energy to overcome entropy. So this is why we say most exergonic reactions, which is what this big blue wheel right here, is used to make ATP. So in this particular case, the products right here are going to be ATP. And if you want to draw this in on the figure, this might be good. Let's get some examples of these reactants right here that have high free energy. Let's put glucose. Put C6H12O6 right here, glucose. All right, so glucose can be broken down into, releasing a lot of energy, can be broken down into what? CO2 and water. That is a highly exergonic metabolic pathway, but that energy is not just wasted, doesn't just go off into outer space. That energy can be used, right, to run this wheel right here, which is taking ADP and inorganic phosphate and make ATP out of it. So for the products on the gray wheel, put ATP. The reactants on the gray wheel, put ADP and inorganic phosphate, which is what? It's this reaction, but which way is it going? It's going to the left, right? So in the gray wheel, the reactants are ADP, inorganic phosphate, and it's going to go to the left. But where does it get the energy from? The blue wheel right here, okay, to make ATP. And then that ATP is used by various other processes inside your cells. All right, here's a nice diagram of ATP. We see three phosphates. Here's the alpha phosphate, here's the beta, here's the gamma. We just talk about it that way. The terminal phosphate, right, is bound to the middle phosphate with a high energy covalent bond. So when this bond is broken, it releases a lot of energy. This is exergonic. And even the second bond, not quite as strong as the third over here, but it still can release a lot of energy. But AMP, cyclic or regular AMP, adenosine monophosphate, does not have any high energy bonds. It's not a high energy molecule. It's got to be either ADP or ATP. All right, so how do you make ATP? You need adenosine diphosphate plus inorganic phosphate. That's what this little I stands for, which is that PO4 group. And then you have this molecule that can carry energy from one set of reactions to another. So I actually think of this as being a coenzyme because it's a big organic molecule and it's transferring something from one set of chemical reactions to another. And sometimes physically this inorganic phosphate group is transferred from one molecule to another, but for sure don't forget what is something that's just like a molecule that can be transferred. Energy. Okay, energy can be donated or taken from various metabolic pathways, and that's really what the job of ATP is, right? It carries energy from one set of reactions to another. All right, well, next time we got to start here with oxidation-reduction reactions, and then that's almost the last bit of this chapter. So I'll see you on Tuesday. Is there a test on Tuesday? No test on Tuesday. Just a lecture. Okay. All right, make sure you sign the sign-in sheets.